So I wanted to talk in this first presentation about solitary confinement. And in the New York City system, like in many systems, there developed over a period of time a reliance on the use of solitary confinement to punish people who had broken jail rules. And so here I'm talking about the jail system in New York City. I don't have any disclosures to report. So we'll talk just a little bit about introduction to the topic, how we came about designing alternatives to solitary confinement, some of the data that we report, and then some of the next steps. So this is the city jail system. It's big. It's the second largest, I think, in the country. There are nine jails open on Rikers Island, and then there are three borough houses, jails that are outside off of Rikers Island in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and a barge that is moored off of Hunts Point in the South Bronx. So as I said, it's big, this jail system. I think that the second bullet there is really where most American correctional health systems find themselves, which is this notion that sick people come to jail and it's a good place to find them and take care of them. I think for us, we really have made a large commitment to the third bullet, which is that correctional settings impart health risks to the people who pass through them. And so it's not simply a matter of finding these sick and troubled people and using the public health opportunity. It's that correctional systems really have the obligation to identify how the correctional setting may impart health risks and how do those risks interact with the risks of the individuals there. And so towards this end, we made the affirmative decision in 2012 to incorporate human rights as a core component of our health mission in the jail system. I should mention that we're in the midst of a transition in our healthcare delivery system. So up until recently, we've had a model where we had an oversight by the Department of Health, which I was part of, and what we oversaw were vendors, and the largest vendor was a large for-profit corporation, Corizon, which is the largest in the country. It's essentially a staffing company that works in lots of jail settings and some prisons. And the city of New York then has transitioned to a new model where the public hospital system, called HHC, Health and Hospitals Corporation, is now going to be responsible for the entire apparatus. And so that means that we don't have an oversight and a delivery group. We have one care delivery group. And my boss, Dr. Patsy Yang, is here, and she's our senior vice president and is going to kind of lead us into this as part of what is the nation's largest public hospital system. Because there are 12 hospitals around New York City that are public hospitals, we now are part of that system. So I'll talk just briefly about the data that we use to help move the policy around solitary confinement. And it's not the only thing. There were lots of other. There were advocates. There were lots of reasons why people felt compelled to get rid of solitary confinement for the serious mental ill. But part of it, large part, a small part, some part, was the data that we reported publicly. So our original analysis in American Journal of Public Health, we took 245,000 jail admissions, and we looked at the health outcomes of self-harm and high lethality self-harm. And this is important because if you look through discussions about solitary, it's generally about emotional, mental distress, things that are very hard to quantify and that lead you down the path of arguing with security folks about, is somebody lying? Are they not lying? Are they truly distressed? Are they a malingerer? And not just security folks, your health staff will do the same thing, right? The health staff will slap that label on them just as quickly as the security staff do. So we elected to look at a hard outcome, which is self-harm. Did somebody hurt themselves? And a subset of that, did somebody hurt themselves in a way that could have led to their death, high lethality self-harm? So we looked at that. So we built a big regression model, as we would do in epidemiology with any other exposure. And what we found is that there were three things that really predicted self-harm: serious mental illness, being an adolescent, and ever being in solitary confinement. And those three things were predictive with risk ratios between 6.5 and 8. So very compelling data to suggest that exposure to this, you know, to being in either any of these three cohorts really predicts this outcome. And colloquially, another way to look at that is that 7% of inmates go through solitary. Among them, however, this small group, you find over half the self-harm and almost half of all the high lethality self-harm. So then we published that data, and then we came back for a second crack at this type of analysis, because we have electronic health record in our system, and so it's, as a primary care doctor, I'm sometimes a little ambivalent about EMRs, but in terms of using it to promote human rights and surveillance of vulnerable populations, it's the best, it's the best human rights tool that I've encountered in our setting. And so here we looked at people who were coming to jail for the first time, and this is a recent publication. And what we found was that non-white patients, and we looked particularly at race and age, because we're looking for disparities here. And we found that non-white patients were less likely to enter the mental health service while they were in jail. That may not be a huge surprise to people, because it's, you know, some of that's been reported elsewhere in the community. What we did find, though, is that in the third bullet, among the people who enter the mental health service, if you take everybody who is in the mental health service, which is probably about, for this cohort, about 40% of them, the non-white patients were much more likely to come into the mental health service later in their stay, and in the context of solitary confinement. That is to say, within a few days of going into solitary. And what I didn't put in there is they also are much more likely to get what you would call a pejorative diagnosis. The white patients were much more likely to get depression and psychotic disorder diagnoses, and the non-white patients were much more likely to get, you know, some sort of Axis II-ish, you know, diagnosis. And the last bullet, which we found compelling, is that Black patients are 2.5 times more likely to go into solitary than whites, and Hispanics 1.8 times. And this is adjusted for length of stay. So this has been our approach to data and data that we've assembled to kind of take multiple cracks at this institution. We, in 2014, really all came to agreement, us, the Department of Corrections, city stakeholders, that we needed to end solitary confinement for seriously mentally ill people. So this will sound horrible, but we had a solitary confinement unit just for people with high levels of mental illness. So this sounds crazy, right? And people would come to New York City and say, I've never encountered this in the United States. But it was a subset of solitary confinement, 200 beds, just for people with mental illness. And so, not surprisingly, the highest rates of violence and all the bad outcomes you can think of happened there. Use of force, horrible things. So we then came to agreement that we should design a new unit. This happened in 2014. And so we decided that for the seriously mentally ill patients who earned infractions, we would design a treatment approach. And so this treatment setting, it would be called Clinical Alternatives to Punitive Segregation. It would be something, a unit whereby the mental health staff identify patients who have earned an infraction and otherwise would have gone into solitary, would then control their entry into the unit, would provide clinical treatment, there would be no punishment, there would be no solitary confinement, and they would decide when people leave the unit. And so this, but what was left out here is that the last bullet, people with lower levels of mental illness still would go into basically a solitary setting. So in many ways, we sometimes talk about serious mental illness as being this golden ticket from Willy Wonka. It's that if you get it, many systems around this country now are creating an alternate path for you, a treatment approach. However, that's a small subset of the people with mental illness. It's also, you might argue, some of the easiest group of patients to treat, because these are often psychotic disorders that respond to medication. So this is, I think that Gabe and I were talking last night, this is kind of the low-hanging fruit in terms of dealing with solitary, but it's important because these are sick, sick patients. So the principles of the unit, I think, are familiar to people who have worked in a lot of other settings that have tried this. I think that the biggest thing is that we identify steady staff, security staff and health staff, that are always going to work on this unit. They're not going to rotate around. They own the units. They train together. They go through quite a full week of training together before they can work. And then there's a lot of program and engagement efforts that go into this. I'll just say that I had a slide with the calendar or the schedule of events, but basically the day starts. The first thing that happens on these units in the morning is a community meeting where the patients, the security staff, and the health staff sit down and kind of hash out what any gripes, anything that's going on. They talk about the day. But it's one of the few places in our setting, in a jail setting, where patients get to express their concerns. It kind of helps keep, it's an accountability measure so that like everybody's hearing what everybody's saying about everybody else. It's important for getting people back on the same page. I think that then we have programs all day, art therapy, individual group therapy, medication adherence counseling, lots and lots of things that we have built it up. And one of the middle bullet there, this is our first time introducing treatment aids. And so these are staff that if you go to an inpatient psychiatric hospital, you'll see them. They're kind of lower level staff with not that much training, like a medical technician or a nursing assistant. But what they're doing is this critical task of engaging with people, finding out who's doing well, who's not doing well, could be playing cards, could be helping people go from here to there, get to group, organize the group. Really critical, because then it takes a lot of the onus off of the clinicians, who are often thinking about, okay, I have to see three patients, I have to do these encounters. And it also helps, again, with accountability, knowing what's getting done, what's not getting done on the unit. So a couple of data slides. Harkening back to our original analyses, we stuck with self-harm as one of them. We have a lot of other data that we haven't yet compiled because it's jointly owned by us and the security staff. And so it's easiest for us, like with preliminary data like this, to report out what's in our EMR. So here, what we're comparing is the rates of self-harm of patients, and this is over a year and a half, the first year and a half the unit was open. During the first year and a half, 185 patients went into this CAPS unit, which is the new unit I've been describing. The other patients, the 2,000 who went into something called the restrictive housing unit, RHU, those are the patients who have the lower level of mental illness but who are still going into solitary. Now, this is an apples and oranges comparison because they're categorically different, right? One is seriously mentally ill patients, one is patients with some behavioral problem, so you might expect that there's a difference, but it's still dramatic to us that the units function with much less self-harm, the clinical units. So then, in order to try and make a more apples-to-apples comparison, we looked at a subset, 90 patients, about who have been in both places. Because believe it or not, there are mentally ill patients, seriously mentally ill patients, as we were rolling this unit out, who had experienced both places. So, you know, if today was the first day that CAPS opened, some of the patients who went in there, many of them, had just been in one of these solitary settings. And so on the left there, just looking at self-harm, the variable we were looking at, we see that among these patients who were in both units, their rates of self-harm were much less than in the CAPS unit than the RHU, the restrictive housing unit, which is the solitary. When we go over to the right and look at another outcome, which we also own, it's in our EMR, which is a verified injury. So we have lots of injury encounters, but for probably every 10 injury visits in our system, four of them include a verified injury. And we have we've published reports about how we've built the EMR so that we can force the doctor to click on boxes. And one of the boxes they click on is there a verified injury? And once you put up that kind of structured variable in your clinical encounter, it allows you to do very good, you know, broad aggregate reporting of these outcomes. So here again, we see the same thing, that the CAPS looks better than RHU for the patients who experience both. So some of the things that we haven't analyzed the data yet, but the staff tell us really are much better: medication adherence, use of force, fights, hospital transfer. Those things I think we'll have good promising data on. So then I think really for us a lot of discussion has ensued about what to do with this unit. The first is the challenges. I think that units like this invariably invite cherry picking. So what that means is the patients that, and everybody does it, the security and the health staff do it. So the health staff, if the health staff have a patient that they're not sure about, that maybe they haven't yet determined are they seriously mentally ill or not, and that patient's very problematic and very assaultive, they may not put that patient in this unit. And we've found some instances like that. Security staff also, you know, in our system with 12 jails, they're really run like 12 feudal entities. And so if you are the warden of the jail with a CAPS unit, you do not want people coming in messing up your jail. And so you may take efforts to keep certain people out also. So cherry picking is an issue. I think that once we get people onto this unit, what we found is we built this unit, a new progressive unit, and we had nowhere to transfer people to because everything else we had was, you know, comparatively horrible. And so we hadn't, you know, in our setting, we have about 25 mental health units. These are just regular units. These are not, have nothing to do with infractions or punishment. And those units didn't have anywhere close to this level of staffing. So to take somebody who'd been on this CAPS unit doing well, they didn't want to go back to the regular mental health units, and their clinicians didn't want to. So that was a big issue. And then, you know, security and treatment priorities are an issue. And the behavioral concerns, I think, is also the group of people who aren't getting onto the unit, the non-SMI. So it's a lot of money, as you can see there. The third set of bullets, we then have taken this model and applied it to our existing mental health units. And so far we've gotten money for four mental health units and convert them. And so the first one we did was a hospital return unit for people that got so sick they went to the hospital and are coming back. The second for people who are decompensating and maybe heading towards the hospital. Another one is an assessment or diagnostic unit, because we all have patients in correctional settings that we don't understand, that we need to parse out a little better. And then the fourth will be people who cycle back and forth between the state mental health system for competency and restoration reasons. So we have taken this model that we started with in the CAPS unit and are trying to apply it little by little to the whole mental health setting, because we find that having these treatment aids, having a treatment approach instead of a punishment approach is better for our patients. I think that, you know, really the thing we haven't done yet, and I haven't seen done really anywhere very well, is how do we take patients with primarily behavioral problems, patients that are assaultive, patients that really don't have psychotic disorders, and how do we do a better job with them? And part of that is, how do we steel ourselves to have tolerance for bad outcomes? So the patients will go maybe from being highly assaultive and having like 5 or 6 bad outcomes a month to maybe 1, and view that as a win, not view that as we tried something and it doesn't work, so let's go back to the old thing. So that's, I think, a core challenge for us. And that's all. I want to thank the DOHMH, because, as I mentioned, we've migrated over, and so a lot of this was done while we were with DOHMH. I want to thank the Department of Corrections. It's really been an important partner in this. And then I also want to thank APHA, because, you know, the first solitary analysis we did was the APHA paper of the year last year. And you always think that your data is important, and it may be or it may not be, but when outsiders do something like that, like wave a wand over it, like there's some press coverage or something, you know, other people think it's important, and it really, just thinking, you know, purely in terms of advancing the agenda for our patients, that really helped. Like, that kind of thing helped us, it helps our patients, and so almost every paper we've published has been in AJPH. And they've been fantastic partners in this work. So thank you.